This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. December 1941, the same day the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, they also struck U.S. bases and ports in the Philippines. Caught in the attack and invasion of the Philippine Islands, 99 American nurses. They became the only group of American women captured and imprisoned by an enemy. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, the story of the women the newspapers call the Angels of Bataan and Corregidor. We talk with Elizabeth Norman, author of We Band of Angels, the untold story of American nurses trapped on Bataan by the Japanese. Listeners, you can join the conversation with a telephone call. Questions and comments are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, our number 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, good wherever you're listening. Toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WILL. Our guest, Elizabeth Norman, is an associate professor of nursing and the director of the doctoral program at New York University's Division of Nursing in the School of Education. Her specialty is nursing history. Norman is also the author of Women at War, the story of 50 military nurses who served in Vietnam. Elizabeth Norman, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
What led you to the stories of the angels?
In part, it was the book that I had done on Vietnam. It's quite interesting to have nurses whose mission is to save lives being put in a war zone where the main aim is to kill. And also, there was a personal angle to it. My mother had served in World War II, and I was very interested in learning about her experiences. She wasn't one of the angels, but about women in uniform during the war.
Yeah. Now, the story of the angels, this is a story that has gone largely unreported. Why?
Well, for two reasons. I think our society is one where we tend to move on very quickly past events. And when World War II was over, people really wanted to get on with their lives. So they didn't want to be reminded, particularly of some of the events in the Philippines, which were very difficult to understand and accept. And the women themselves wanted to move into private lives after 3 years as prisoners of war. So I think it's a combination of their wanting to be normal and society's need to move on that kind of led to this just avoidance of this amazing story.
Mm. And despite all their accomplishments, these women are quite unassuming.
You know, I wish you could meet them. It's just amazing. I've never met a more humble or unassuming group of people in my life. You would never know until you sat down and talked to them what they had done and gone through.
Yeah. So it was a challenge to tell their stories, you say, in the outset of the book, because, you know, they were very modest about what they had been through.
Well, they were and they are. It's difficult to interview someone who will tell you about the experience but wants to talk about the other people in the experience whom she feels did more or were braver than she was. So they kept deflecting personal questions and preferred to talk about the group, even using the pronoun we instead of I during the interview.
Yeah. That's one of the things you talk about in the book as well, is the experience of being imprisoned in Manila at the camp. It was so crowded, conditions were so tough that personal identity was distorted. The individual was lost.
Yes, and it was. The women say it was a daily struggle just to keep heart and soul together as a person, because there was no chance to be alone anywhere, anytime. You shared everything from bathroom facilities, sleeping facilities, where you ate. There were, you know, thousands of people crowded on this small university campus, and I happened to visit Santo Tomas last January when I was in the Philippines. Now I'm even more amazed, having actually been there, at how small the site was and how many people were forced into that land for so long.
Yeah. All the women who were in prison survived. Mm-hmm. How many survived today?
There are, of the nurses who went into prison camp, there are 13 still alive out of the original 77. And then there was a group of 21 who were evacuated before surrender, and of those 21, two are still alive. So a total of, my math here, 15.
Hmm. What motivated these women to become military nurses?
Well, they primarily went into the military to escape what was a very hard lifestyle in our country in the 1930s during the Depression. The pay was better in the military, a little bit better than it was in the private sector, and they also had a chance to escape the farms and the working class world where they grew up and travel to exotic places, as they said, like San Diego or Brooklyn, New York, and then they got to go overseas. So they really liked the adventure and the exotic nature of being able to serve in the Pacific.
Yeah. What were their lives like in the Pacific before the Japanese attack?
Well, they were described to me as something that probably you and I would have enjoyed a lot less.
Yeah.
It was a paradise. It was a true tropical paradise. The nurses had servants to do all their household chores. They had a working schedule of 4 hours a day, that's it, and the rest of the time they were free. Their money went a long way, so they could shop for silks, they could travel. There were lots of a businessman who worked for Pan Am, so there was an enormous social life. And one nurse summed it up when she said, all you needed to have a great life in the Philippines was your white nurse's uniform, you needed a bathing suit, and you needed an evening gown. That's it.
Yeah.
I thought that really summed it up. It was paradise, they say.
Yeah. But now the world is, not quite all the world is at war.
Yeah.
But there is war in Europe. Were these nurses fearful or concerned at all that the U.S. would become involved in war, that their lives would change?
You know, they weren't. There had been rumors, but there was such a sense among the Americans in the Philippines that there was no way Japan would ever attack America. How could a small island country attack this great country that had won World War II, had come out of the Depression? They just never really believed that it would happen, and they were quite naive and also quite unprepared.
Yeah. Did their training address the possibility, any possibility, that they would be sent onto the battlefield? Because, after all, these women were the first American military nurses sent onto the battlefield.
There was nothing in their training, either in nursing school or in the military. There was no military training for nurses at that point. They had military rank, but they were still called Miss Smith or Miss Jones. And they didn't even have they only had their white nurses' uniforms. They didn't even have field uniforms. Survival training, any sort of field training, was utterly unknown. If anything prepared them at all, it was their nursing school training, where at some points as students they had to work 12 hours a day, and it was hard physical labor. So in an indirect way, that prepared them for the battles.
After the experiences that these women had on the battlefield and their experiences as prisoners, did the military change its training for nurses?
It didn't. The training for nurses changed while these women were imprisoned as POWs. They did increase the preparation for military nurses, both stateside and going overseas. But what surprised me and dismayed me a little, when these women came home, here you had 77 women who went through an experience that no group had ever gone through before, and they never tapped this experience. Even the women who stayed in the military and served in Korea or served other places, I asked each one of them, and they said no one ever asked us what we learned over there.
Mm.
So we missed a great opportunity.
That's amazing. They were seen, though. They certainly had value as tools for PR.
Well, when they first came home, here you had a group of women who, in a sense, had also beaten the Japanese. So they were a great recruiting tool, and they also were symbols of what, how strong the individual Americans were. So they were treated as heroines and held up as models for other women to follow. But they were still regarded as just nurses. They were not regarded as people who had been in the worst of battle and people who had endured enemy internment, because these ideas kind of broke the mold of what we thought about women and nurses, and people just weren't quite willing or able to deal with that. So they were heroines, but in a very traditional female way.
Mm. There's a woman in the book, one of the remarkable women, Helen Cassie Cassiani.
Yes.
It's Christmas Eve, 1941, and the wounded at Fort Stotzenberg are to be moved to Sternberg Hospital, mm-hmm. another hospital, and she was to be in charge of the train that would take the patients to Manila.
Mm-hmm.
Would you tell us how she was prepared for that assignment?
Yes. Fort Stotzenberg was adjacent to Clark Field, where most of our Pacific Air Force had been, and it was destroyed the first day of the war, which was December 8th in the Philippines, same day as Pearl Harbor, just over the dateline. And the casualties when the Japanese destroyed Clark Airfield were enormous. Cassie went up there from Manila, volunteered, worked in the hospital, but they couldn't sustain the hospital. The base was gone, so they had to move all of the patients and staff back to Manila. Cassie was getting the patients ready to go into ambulances and any other vehicles when she was told to stop her work, and an Army sergeant came up to her and said she had to go with him, so she followed him. He hands her a sock filled with cartridges or bullets and a gun, and she said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm going to teach you how to shoot." They went to the jungle, which surrounded the base, and started to use the large flowers that grew in the jungle as targets, and he taught her how to shoot. Now, fortunately, Cassie was a farm girl, and she was used to unfeminine things, so she had handled a gun before but never shot it like this. While they were shooting, the indigenous tribe came out of the jungle, and Cassie thought, "My God, this is like a movie set." Well, after a very short time, the sergeant took her from their target range in the jungle and took her to the train, and that was all the preparation and equipment she had. She was in charge, and if there was any problem, she had to deal with either the enemy or an American patient who was losing control. So she was scared to death. She said she couldn't probably shoot the broadside of a barn, and here she was with this hand weapon and bullets on her uniform.
Yeah. Well, these women did not consider themselves soldiers.
No.
At least in the early going. Did that ever change? Did they begin to see themselves differently over their time in the Pacific?
They did. When the Army evacuated Manila and went to the jungles of Bataan and the island of Corregidor to what they had hoped would be a holding action until reinforcements could come, the nurses, of course, went with the Army. They set up the hospitals deep in the Bataan jungles, and they were as primitive facilities as I think have ever happened in the Army since the Civil War. And the women were right in the thick of things. The shells were going over them. Their hospital was bombed. They didn't have enough food, so they were hungry. They all got sick because there wasn't enough medicine. So they endured exactly what the average soldier endured. And over the course of weeks or months, they began to assume more of a soldier military identity. And they very much, by the time Bataan surrendered in April of 1942, felt that they were soldiers.
Yeah.
They dressed like the men and everything else. So.
They were the first to wear fatigues.
I believe so. And again, these weren't fatigues specifically made for women. When they got to the jungles, their white uniforms weren't going to work. So they were initially issued Army Air Corps coveralls that had been made for the men, all size 42, which were big. And they just they took them in and wore them. And I believe that they were the first to wear fatigues into the field during war.
Hmm. The attack on the Philippine Islands followed the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
How much time was there between the two?
Simply a matter of hours, depending on who you read. The command in the Philippines was notified anywhere from 3 to 6 hours later. And the first bombs fell on the Philippines about 8 o'clock that morning, which would have been about 6 hours after Pearl Harbor, very soon after
that disaster. But still, hours.
Uh-huh.
And the U.S. forces were not prepared.
No. And this is certainly a story for other military historians. For whatever reason, the command staff didn't notify the people lower in the command so preparations could be made, and certainly didn't notify the medical people until the bombs started to fall.
Yeah. You know, this is a part of the war that I think for most of us is not part of our, you know, what we learned in school about the war.
Well, I think the initial attack was certainly hidden under the great tragedy of Pearl Harbor. And also the liberation of the Philippines is somewhat lost in the other great battles and victories that we fought in the Pacific, such as Iwo Jima and Okinawa. And also the one thing that sets the Philippine campaign apart is the fact that our American and Filipino forces were forced to surrender. So I wonder on some level if this was the one battle seen as the losing battle of the war.
Mm.
There could be many reasons for that, but it certainly is an overlooked part of the war.
Yeah. Beginning on December 8th, how much damage did the Japanese do?
Well, they destroyed every base that we had on the island of Luzon, and we had huge airfields, Cavite Naval Yard, huge naval base, completely just flattened. They destroyed our fleet, they destroyed our air force, and they were bombing Manila, the port area, at whim. And one of the reasons we pulled out of the city is they were afraid of massive civilian casualties. But the damage that was done was widespread and just, it was enormous.
The squadrons at Clark were reduced to 7 aircraft.
Yes. Again, they were left on the airfield fully fueled and fully loaded with bombs, and the pilots and the crews went to lunch. And while they were at lunch, just squads of Mitsubishi bombers flew in and destroyed the base. The nurses said it was so bad that the planes that were there looked like dinosaur skeletons. That was about all that was left.
How many dead?
Surprisingly, when you think about it, not that many. There were about 80 dead soldiers, civilians, et cetera, that day at Clark Field. I'm surprised it wasn't much more.
Mm.
And the men were hit the ground, and, I mean, all they had, many of them, were 1902 Enfield rifles from World War I, and they were shooting at the planes in their frustration with antique weapons.
Mm. Attacks from the air continued well beyond December 8th.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Japanese invasion began later in the month, December 22nd.
Yes.
When did Manila fall?
Manila was declared an open city right after Christmas when the troops began to pull out. And that was supposed to mean that there would be no combat in that city because there was no military. The Japanese entered the city on January 2nd. 1942, and took over. At that point, all of the army was on Bataan and Corregidor. The handful of Navy nurses, and there were only 11 Navy women and physicians and patients, they were in Manila, so they surrendered January 2nd.
Yeah. The Navy nurses remaining in Manila, why weren't they evacuated?
Well, no one could answer that question for me, and I asked lots of people and read lots of official reports, and I really think what happened, you have to think of almost the chaos that was taking place in the Philippines as things were crumbling around them, and the Army had tens of thousands of troops to get out. I think they forgot. I just think that they were lost in the chaos of the retreat and left behind.
Yeah. And eventually they would wind up with the Army nurses who would come back.
Yes.
And they to be imprisoned at Santo Tomas.
Yes, the Navy nurses went into that prison camp in March of 1942. The Army nurses who were surrendered much later on, a few months later, showed up in August of 1942, so they did come together again.
Yeah. These 11 nurses left in Manila, remarkable stories. Tell us the steps they took to keep their supplies from being looted by the Japanese.
Well, one of the things that this group just inherently had was a great savvy about them. Again, no one sat them down and told them what to do or gave them guidelines to follow. But these Navy nurses knew that the Japanese were going to come through and loot, because it happens every time there's an army surrendered, which they did. And after they took the watches and the jewelry and the things that they wanted, they ordered the Navy nurses to go into their supply closet and label all of their medicines. Now, medicines were quite limited at the time, and they just knew that the Japanese were going to take the most valuable medicines, especially quinine, to fight malaria. So when they went through and did their inventory, they mislabeled the medicines. And quinine, for example, they labeled the bicarbonate of soda, which was common and didn't mean anything. When the Japanese came through, they left the quinine behind, and they took something else that was useless but labeled quinine. It just, someone, they just knew what to do.
Yeah. How did they, were they afraid, and how did they deal with their fear?
They were terrified. One of them said, "I was scared spitless." They didn't know what was going to happen to them, if they were just going to be summarily shot, or, you know, the rape of Nanking had occurred 3 years earlier. It was very much on their minds. But they held themselves together because they looked to one another, and their chief nurses, women who were World War One veterans, were very strong, confident, quiet people, and they just helped one another get through it. They knew that if they became hysterical, that the Japanese would probably take advantage of it. So they remained very calm and very quiet and adopted a policy of, let's just keep our heads down.
Yeah. And apparently their attitude and their uniforms really helped them.
It did. The Japanese had tens of thousands of prisoners to deal with, so they couldn't spend much time worrying about a small group of Navy nurses or a larger but still small group of Army nurses. So what worked in their favor is that the Japanese were shocked and surprised to see these women wearing khaki or blue uniforms because there were no females in the Japanese military, and they didn't know what to do with them. The women had Red Cross armbands on, so they just figured, well, we'll let them stay and work as nurses, which they did. And that very much worked in their survival strategy, because they did not have to endure what the men went through.
Well, Elizabeth Norman is our guest this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. We're talking with her about her book, We Band of Angels, The Untold Story of American Nurses Trapped on Bataan by the Japanese. My name is Celeste Quinn. If you'd like to join the conversation this afternoon, give us a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else you're listening, call us toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. That's 800-222-WILL. Questions and comments are welcome. This evacuation to Bataan was quite an undertaking. By January 7th of 42, more than 100,000 people on the peninsula. What were conditions like there?
Bataan at the time was probably some of the densest jungle in the world, and certainly some of the most malaria-infested places on the planet. It was very primitive. It was in no way set up to handle 100,000 soldiers and civilian refugees. There was basically one road that ran down one of the coastlines of the peninsula, another one across, but most of the land was dormant volcanoes and mountains, and were covered with thick jungle. Again, I was there last January, and it's still quite remote, so I can imagine what it was like with all these people there. There was no food, certainly no shelter anywhere. Very primitive and difficult place to fight and take care of patients.
Well, there are two field hospitals, and I think we can say that that's maybe an exaggeration to call them hospitals. What were these facilities like?
The hospital number one, which had been planned all along, was originally on the seacoast, but it got a little too close to the fighting, so they moved it inland to a place that had been an engineer's area, and there were a few open tin sheds that they could use and put patients under, and a few tents they could put up. So that was primitive, but that was luxurious compared to this hospital number two, which was set up after the battle started when they realized that they couldn't handle all the casualties at one place. And hospital number two was literally carved out of the jungle. Bulldozers would clear paths and clear small open spaces. Beds would be placed right on the jungle floor, or when they ran out of beds, the men were right on the ground themselves, and there was nothing overhead, just the jungle canopy.
Yeah, and conditions were terrible. Gangrene and malaria were rampant.
Yes.
Talk with us about surviving. What happened to folks there when trying to survive gangrene and malaria?
Well, the difficulty with gangrene, again, there weren't enough medicines, and one of the physicians there developed quite a unique treatment for the gangrene, where the wounds would be left open to the sun, because the organism that caused gangrene is oxygen can kill it. So they felt by leaving it open to the air it would work, and it did work. The malaria patients got as much quinine as they could possibly ration to each person, but basically, if you got malaria, you had malaria, and you just had to see it through. And everyone had it, from the soldiers and Marines who were fighting to the hospital staff. On top of it, whenever you're sick, nutrition is so important, and sleep, and both were in short supply there because of the noise of the fighting, which was nearby, and we didn't have enough food. Quickly went through the regular army food, then they shot the cavalry horses and ate those, and they foraged in the jungle and ate whatever they could. So people were on two meals a day, losing weight. At the same time, they were fighting, working, and trying to deal with these tropical diseases.
Mm. And back home, what did people know about what was going on?
During the battle itself, there were correspondents on Corregidor and Bataan for major publications such as Life magazine. They were able to get stories out on the very few over the radio and other ways. So the people back home knew about the battles, but the individual nurse couldn't get any news home. I mean, this was long, long before communications became so easy with cell phones, and so they were cut off from their families almost from the first day of the war. Very difficult for both the women to deal with, and certainly for their families back home.
Yeah, and back home they were really dissed in the New York Times. Tell us the story that
there was a physical,
got out.
A physical therapist, a woman who was with the nurses, who managed to get a letter home, I assume on one of the few planes that might have flown to the southern islands to pick up supplies and drop off mail. And her parents gave the letter to a correspondent. It was reprinted in the New York Times, and it didn't describe the battle or the suffering of the people. Rather, it talked about like a hairpin shortage. Again, people needed to think about these women in such traditional female roles that it was okay to read things like that. It probably, they felt it wouldn't have helped morale at home to learn that these women were starving and sick. I mean, again, this was a tough time in the war for our country. We were still losing, and I think that the press was very careful about what appeared in print.
Yeah.
And the War Department, of course.
Yeah. Hospital number one suffered a direct hit by the Japanese, mm-hmm. and there were quite a few dead, 73 dead, mm-hmm. many more injured, including some nurses. What happened to the nurses, and how serious were their injuries?
Well, the Japanese bombed that hospital twice. At the very end of March, one day they bombed the entrance and killed several dozen Filipino workers. They apologized, but then they, less than a week later, came back and it was bombed again. Now, there were big red crosses on the tin roofs and a big sheet with a red cross on it. Still, they dropped the bombs, and two of them landed 500-pound bombs directly on a patient ward. bodies were blown into trees. It was just a disaster. Two nurses were injured. One of them had a lot of shrapnel in the face and a punctured eardrum. Another one had a broken finger and shrapnel in her chest and leg. These two women were evacuated off Bataan that night across 2 miles of water to the island of Corregidor for treatment. But eventually they went into prison camp, and to the end of her life, one of them said she still had shrapnel in her chest and would set off the airport metal detectors every time she went through.
And one of these women, Rosemary Hogan, I believe it was, said, oh, I'm... She crawled out and she said, oh, just a bloody nose.
Well, they... Again, the women, when they looked around and they saw all these mangled and dead bodies, and to them, I guess a fractured eardrum was nothing. And also, they very much they were not complainers. They're not complainers today. They weren't then. They were just part of this effort, and they just kept going.
Yeah.
You know, there was no self-pity at all.
Josie Nesbitt,
yeah.
Terrific lady.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes clear that Bataan will have to surrender,
mm-hmm.
So an evacuation is ordered. But the evacuation order is just for the American nurses, and there are many Filipino nurses
mm-hmm.
working side by side with the American nurses. And Josie Nesbitt, she said, no way,
mm-hmm.
they're coming too.
That's right, and that says a lot about her, because Josie and the other nurses, they really did what they were told. They followed orders. They never questioned authority. But there was something about the order of leaving her Filipino staff behind that Josie just couldn't live with. So for the first time in her military career, she stood up to a superior officer and said, either they go or none of us go. And they changed the order. And she was able to bring all the Filipino nurses to Corregidor.
Yeah. The experience of the Filipino nurses, similar to the American nurses, or different?
It was identical up until the point after the surrender on Corregidor, where the Army and Filipino nurses were. In July of 1942, the Japanese moved everyone off of Corregidor except for a handful of people. And when they got to the docks of Manila, the Filipino nurses were sent to Bilibid Prison, which was a military prisoner of war camp. The nurses went to a civilian prisoner of war camp. The Filipino nurses were held there for a short time, about a month. They were then released to go home after they signed an oath stating that they would basically behave themselves. So they spent 1 month in the prison camp as opposed to the Americans, who were held for the duration.
Hmm. So let's back up a little bit, and I want to make sure that the audience can follow along here.
Yes.
Bataan is forced to surrender,
mm-hmm.
so there's the evacuation to Corregidor
mm-hmm.
and its tunnels, and Corregidor is an island.
Mm-hmm.
And then not long after that, what was it, just less than a month,
yes.
The island of Corregidor fell.
Yes, it was May 6th that it fell, less than a month later. And the Americans, even on Bataan and later Corregidor, kept hoping and hoping for a convoy, some kind of reinforcements. But gradually, and the women said to me, if we didn't believe in those rumors, it would have been hard to keep going. But once Bataan was surrendered, the Japanese turned their entire arsenal on this very small 3-mile island that looks like a tadpole and just bombed it so bad that compasses don't even work today. There's still so much metal on that island. There was no way that we could hold out, and it slowly began to dawn on everyone that they were going to have to surrender. And again, the nurses were simply scared to death. They stayed at their job. They didn't cry or get hysterical, but they were frightened out of their minds about what was going to happen to them.
Mm-hmm. And eventually they were moved to Manila, Santo Tomas.
Yes.
How many people were there? How big a space is that?
Well, it was approximately 60 acres, and there were at one point about, over 4,000 people in this 60-acre property, and it was everyone from newborn infants to quite elderly people who were rounded up and thrown into this camp. So it was almost like a mini city. It was very interesting, different cultures, Dutch, Canadian, French, American, all in this camp together.
And what were conditions like there?
Well, the problem with the camp, they never really had enough food, so they were able, at least the first 2 years, to buy food if they had money on the Filipino market. They'd let vendors into the camp. Also, again, the crowding, and there was no place to turn for some solitude. And the isolation, they didn't know what was really going on in the war. There was a radio, but not many people had the true news, so a lot of rumors. And to be cut off and isolated, and most important for Americans, they had no control over their day anymore. They couldn't decide what they were going to eat or when they were going to eat. Everything was ordered for them, and it was very difficult for Americans to give up their freedom. I'm sure it was for the other allies, too, but I only spoke to the Americans, and they said, you just don't know what that's like to lose the ability to make any choice at all about your life.
Boredom, monotony. Mm-hmm. Big problem. Mm-hmm. How did they pass the time?
Well, the nurses would do group activities. They'd get together and sing songs. They'd teach one another to knit and embroider. So they'd do pastimes such as that. Also, there had been college professors and teachers who had been thrown into this camp, too, and they set up classes. And the women, lots of them took classes in music appreciation or Spanish. So they made a real effort to fill their days. And they, in the beginning of the internment, before people got really sick and weak, they'd put on variety shows. So there was sports activities. There were things to keep you busy during the day.
Yeah. Somebody was a big baseball fan, so there was a baseball team.
Well, there were several hundred young men and other men who set up their own. There was soccer and rugby and football and baseball teams. And the women set up softball teams, and there were four of them in the camp. And Cassie, the nurse we spoke about earlier, was the captain of the nurses' team. So they actually got out there and played softball. And every time were beaten by the high school girls' team because they were just much better athletes.
Mm. Although that had to end because of the food situation, malnutrition was a horrible problem.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have the strength.
Through 1942 and 43, the conditions we just spoke about pretty much is what happened. But in 1944, the Japanese military took over the running of the camp, and things got very difficult then. They could no longer buy food on the outside. They had to live on what the Japanese gave them or what they had hoarded. So the calorie count began to drop, and by the end of the year, they were all eating less than 1,000 calories a day. And these were not protein or good calories, empty. So people started to suffer from beriberi. People started to die from beriberi and other diseases of starvation. And it took all someone's energy simply to walk 10 steps and then sit down. It was really a matter of, it was a dying camp at that point.
Yeah. What happens in a case of beriberi?
There are two kinds. There's a wet beriberi where people swell up. Their limbs look like elephant's limbs. Very painful, and it can be fatal because of what it does to the vital organs like the heart. There's also a dry beriberi where you don't have the swelling, but the nerve endings are absolutely raw, and it's just impossible to walk, and that also can be fatal. These are slow, debilitating, painful diseases and deaths.
Were the Japanese trying to starve these folks?
There's been nothing official said along those lines, but they just didn't care, and I think the more people who died, the less people they had to deal with. There was some just either systematic starvation or just cruel indifference to these people, but there was no measure given at all to, they were letting the children starve, let alone the adults in the group, so there was a real callousness to what went on.
Yeah.
And these were civilians now. These were not military people.
It was so bad that people started to not hallucinate, but fantasize mm-hmm. about food.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe you would tell us about recipe mania.
Well, I found that so fascinating. Again, the last year when people were starving, one of the pastimes, because people no longer had the energy to play sports or study, is they started to copy recipes out of magazines and cookbooks and share the recipes. And these were, they were the most creamy, fat-laden foods you could imagine. And they'd sit around for hours, and they'd talk about these recipes and the ingredients and how they'd change them. And curiously, the nurses who took part in this, and thousands of people did this, this was not an isolated pastime, said somehow when you got finished talking about food, you weren't quite as hungry as you were before. It was, as one put it, a banquet of words.
Hmm. I suppose if you could soothe your imagination, if you could be there, in a sense, if your mind could be there at the table.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and again, and the men also did this too. This wasn't just a gender activity, but it's very curious.
Yeah, because I would think as soon as somebody started that, you'd be like, please, stop, get out of here, go away.
There were a few nurses who couldn't take part and who would yell at their bedmate or roommate saying, you know, oh, shut up, I don't want to hear about chocolate cake.
Yeah.
And one nurse was reading a book, and she had to stop because in the novel they kept referring to a lamb stew, and she just got hungrier when she heard about it.
Then liberation, February 1945.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like for those people in that camp?
Well, as one of the nurses said, all they had left in their lives were the sunsets and the sunrises, and they had watched the sunset that night, and they were, of course, they had to stay in the building, and they had smelled something funny. There had been a lot of military activity in the city. They knew something was going on. They didn't know what. All of a sudden, they heard this crash, and these tanks came into the camp. They didn't know whose tanks they were, but they pulled right up in front of the building where the nurses were. Everybody's peering out the windows. All of a sudden, the tops flip open, and a man jumps down and yells up, "Hello, folks." So they knew right away they were the Americans. They came running out of the building, screaming, crying, kissing the ground. Someone saw the American flags on the tanks, and it was the first time in 3 years they had seen the flag. And all of a sudden, there were hundreds of people surrounding these three tanks. Someone started to sing, "God Bless America," and the whole crowd began to sing, and one of the correspondents who accompanied the tank said it was the most moving moment in the whole Pacific campaign for him. And once the singing stopped and the nurses were talking more, they realized the smell that they didn't recognize was gasoline. It was the tanks coming in. They hadn't smelled it in so long, they didn't quite remember what it was.
Well, so if they didn't remember the smell of gasoline, what was it like to go home?
It was disorienting. On one hand, they were thrilled beyond words, but when they first got home, they had a difficult time simply walking around without asking for permission. The cars were so big. Everything seemed to be moving so fast. The colors in the department stores, the menus in the restaurants, it was all startling to these women for quite a while. So they say that it was very disorienting. And people also really didn't want to hear what they'd been through. It's over, people. You know, forget about it, they'd say. And the women wanted to talk about it a little bit, and on top of it all, they were physically sick. They had beriberi, they had TB, they had lots of problems, so they didn't feel real well either.
Yeah, there's a picture in the book that just speaks so eloquently with a movie star, Jeanette MacDonald, I believe. Surrounded by nurses who have just been liberated, and what a difference. I mean, these women look so ill, and the movie star is just this picture of beautiful health.
And that's exactly why I put it in there. When I saw it, I thought, it's wonderful. She's in an evening gown.
With roses.
Ill-fitting uniforms. And if you look at their eyes, you can just see the amazing difference.
Yeah. Any thought to telling the story of the women of Korea?
Perhaps. I'm actually working on a book now with my husband, Michael, about the men, the soldiers, sailors, and Marines who fought on Bataan and Corregidor. So we're doing a book about them right now. After that, perhaps.
Okay. Well, I look forward to that next book.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
It was a pleasure.
Elizabeth Norman has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. Look for her book, We Band of Angels, The Untold Story of American Nurses Trapped on Bataan by the Japanese. It's published by Random House.